This is a YUN interview with Sir Donald Logan in London, England, on April the 22nd, 1991. The interviewer is Sutherland.
You want to test it out for?
I've already done that.
You've already?
That is essential, I might say.
Yes.
And sometimes I use microphones, but it's very quiet here, so there's no problem.
Good.
Anyhow, Sir Donald, I want first of all to express appreciation for your participation in this Yale University Oral History Project related to the United Nations. And if we may, I'd like to talk this morning directly about the Suez Crisis in 1956. And if I could, I would like first to ask you for the record what your position was at that particular time in the British government.
Well, during the Suez Crisis itself, I was the private secretary to Selwyn Lloyd, who was the British foreign secretary. I had been appointed to the post of assistant private secretary at the end of 1955, when Macmillan was already foreign secretary. But by the time I got there, which was in the middle of January, 56, Macmillan had moved on and Selwyn Lloyd was foreign secretary. I was with him for the next 3 years and saw that very early on in his occupation of the post, he was concerned about the Middle East, if only because it reflected the great concern which Eden was showing and had been showing about the role of Nasser in Egypt. Selwyn, taking over as foreign secretary, felt, I think, that he'd been promoted a bit before his time, and therefore it was fairly natural that he took considerable account of Eden's views. However, by the end of January or February, he persuaded Eden that before Selwyn made up his mind about Middle East policy, he would want to go to the Middle East, and particularly to go and see Nasser and see whether it was not possible to come to some accommodation, or rather to accommodate British foreign policy in the Middle East with what Nasser was intending to do. And that took us to Egypt on the 1st of March 1956 for an interview between Selwyn and Nasser, at which Selwyn was to try to take stock of the man and see what could be done. It was while he was actually away at dinner with Nasser that we received news of the dismissal of General Glubb, the British military commander of the Jordan Legion. And of course that was clearly something that was going to convince Eden that Nasser was behind all these moves, and we could immediately see that Selwyn Lloyd's task in reaching an independent judgment on Nasser was going to be ruined if he made the judgment without knowing that this had happened. And we had the embarrassing and awkward decision to take whether to get this information through to Selwyn, knowing that it would really be a very considerable blow to him, or whether to hold it back, to give him a chance of sorting the man out and coming to his own conclusion, and then fitting it with this new development afterwards. We were very much in that direction, letting nothing happened, just see how it came out. But it seemed a great, the thing which really turned us in the end is that we knew that Eden had already seen it. And therefore, for Selwyn to come back and say that he hadn't known about it at the dinner would really make it very difficult to explain to Eden. And so we sent it down. But fortunately, fate did our work for us. because although the message got through to Harold Catcher, who was at the dinner, it didn't get through to Selwyn until at the end of the dinner, the end of the conversation, indeed. And so the two things, in fact, were brought about. But I only mention this at some length because it is an indication that Selwyn really did want to try to find a way of getting out of this awful confrontation that was developing with NASA, and of trying to persuade Eden that there was some other way forward. Then we went on a tour of the Middle East, I think the next 10 days, and came back, I think, in the middle of March. And then there were various attempts made to work out a Middle East policy, particularly with the United States, which I'm sure is well documented as well. And then along came the rumors of, well, first of all, there was the issue of the Aswan Dam, which again comes into the picture, but in which I had very little to do. And then there is the nationalization at the end of July.
What was Selwyn Lahr's impression of NASA?
He always had the idea at the back of his mind that we ought to be able to live with the man. He never really shared Eden's determination to get rid of him. I don't think he really went along with Eden's favorite equation of NASA with Hitler.
I wanted to ask you that because in reading the literature of the time, including Selwyn Lahr's book and Pino's book, this phrase often appears, that Hitler-like, and it's a rather, it occurs now, or it did occur a few months ago in descriptions of Saddam Hussein.
Right. Yeah.
And so I was wondering whether, in fact, that did represent Selwyn Lahr's view. Did he think of Nasser in these terms?
No, I don't think he did think of it in those terms. In any case, I think he probably would feel that there he was, and Hitler or no, one must try somehow to get the best out of it.
Which leads me to another question. His French counterpart, Monsieur Pinault, also saw Nasser just about the same time, I think, in those months during the summer. And he appears to have had a somewhat similar impression that this was a man you could eventually live with. But in later meetings, which Eden and Selwyn Lahr had with the French, they seem to have gotten the impression that that Pinault was very, what we would call, hard-nosed on it and was not interested in a settlement. Could you give your recollection of that, of this bilateral interplay between the French and the British on the question of how to deal with NASA?
Well, I think the thing was uppermost in the French mind, of course, was what was going on in Algeria. And they suspected him of being deeply involved in Algeria and were determined to topple him for that reason.
For reasons other than the canal?
Yes. The canal came along to make it all the more important that they should get rid of him. The canal was very much a French company, and they felt that really there was yet another example of NASA undermining French interests.
There were, I think, consultations, not at a very senior level, among the British, French, and the Americans during that summer, late in summer, about what to do about Nasser. Do you recall if there was any consensus that emerged from these conversations that included Americans at that point?
I was not really involved in those. It was Evelyn Chakra who was doing the shuttle work on that. No, I really have little I can say on that.
I have a general question. Now, you mentioned that Selwyn Lahr became Foreign Secretary just in December of 1955, so he was new on the job almost. But he had had experience at the United Nations earlier as Minister of State, I think. And my question is, did you gain the impression that he had any particular perception of the United Nations, of the effectiveness of the organization, of the utility of the organization, as he undertook his work as Foreign Secretary.
Yes, I think his time as Minister of State at the UN gave him a very good impression of the UN, and I think he thought he could very well work with it.
A positive impression.
Yes.
Because that leads to the next question. As the situation with Egypt intensified, and particularly at the time when the indications of nationalization became credible, was there any thought of going to the United Nations at that point, bringing the whole question to the United Nations before the actual crisis erupted?
Sorry, from what point?
Well, before the nationalization took place, before you...
Before nationalization? Yeah. No, the issue then was the height, it was the Aswan Dam, wasn't it? It was all World Bank discussion.
Although there were already threats, I think, from spoken threats from Nasser, but the action hadn't been taken.
I don't think they were taken seriously enough to consider policy of going to the UN.
I see. But there was no rejection, so to speak, of going to the UN at an earlier stage. It just wasn't considered.
No.
Another question I have of a general nature is the attitude toward Israel. In that tour of the Middle East, by the way, did Selwyn Lloyd include Israel or not?
Yes, we were in Tel Aviv on the way back.
You were. And did he meet the Israeli leaders at that point? Ben Gurion.
I can't remember who he met, but he went there to meet them, so he must have met them. Was Golda Meir
yes.
Foreign Minister?
She was the Foreign Minister.
I think she was. I think he thought she saw Golda Meir.
Yes.
But he went there for that purpose. I just can't remember the personality, but I suspect it was Golda Meir.
And did Selwyn Lloyd enter this crisis, so to speak, with any particular attitude toward Israel or the Israelis?
No, I don't think he did. He certainly didn't have any prejudice against them. Questions never occurred to me before what his attitude to Israel was. It's difficult to distinguish it from the general attitude to Israel at that time, which I think he would have shared. It was only about 9 years, I think, wasn't it, since we had been in the...
That's right.
The country. And
under difficult circumstances.
I felt we were rather turned out. We were not blaming the Israelis for that, but the way the Israelis had made it difficult for the mandate force didn't... sympathy on our part.
One reason I ask this question is because it is often reported that there was a strong Arabist faction in the Foreign Office at that point. Could you confirm that?
I don't know what it means. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are always Arabists in the Foreign Office, of course. There are people expert in Asia, there are people expert in Africa. This business always of the Foreign Office is always pro-Arab seems to be quite absurd.
Yeah.
Our interests in the Middle East have always been closely connected with the Arabs, and therefore it would be rather absurd if there was not understanding and sympathy for those people with whom we've got to deal. I certainly think that the idea that the Foreign Office was pro-Arab at that time in comparison with the attitude of the people of the country, is grossly exaggerated.
In any event, the policy that was eventually followed would not seem to represent what the Arab experts might have recommended.
Certainly not. And Anthony Eden, after all, spent a great deal of his time surrounded by Foreign Office people, and I think was probably happiest when he was surrounded by Foreign Office people.
Which raises the question, what were the dominant influences on Selwyn Lloyd and on Anthony Eden, for that matter, from the Foreign Office in dealing with this crisis. Was there any particular...
From what date, one has to ask?
Well, one has to, I think one has to, well, let me begin at a particular point there, because the summer was a summer of considerable tension on the borders of Israel. Israel and Jordan.
Babel with Jordan.
That's right. And at one point, Britain, I think, felt compelled to warn Israel that if Israel should take action against Jordan, then the British treaty with Jordan would come into effect. That is more or less the place where I am.
And the tripartite declaration would not.
Well, that's one of my questions. Mm-hmm. Was the tripartite declaration at all a consideration?
We'll leave that if you like.
All right. Because just to jump ahead, I can't find much evidence that the tripartite declaration was considered a lie at this point. But may I ask that question right now? As this tension grew in the summer, the tripartite declaration, in theory, was still in effect. But was it a lie? Did you consider it a live document, so to speak?
From Eden's point of view?
Yes, from Eden's point of view.
It was unfortunately not dead.
Really?
Yes. Mm-hmm. He certainly regarded it as an impediment to what he wanted to do.
He did.
And he had to dispose of that impediment.
I see. And to jump far ahead, if indeed he thought, approached this whole problem as if the Tripartite Declaration still had force, what would have been the American role then in the event of an Israeli attack against Egypt? The Tripartite Declaration would seemingly have meant coming to the support of Egypt.
Well, that was the impediment. That was the difficulty.
That was the impediment.
Well, anybody coming, not an American coming, but that was the difficulty about the declaration was that it implied that, which was unthinkable.
So that was not taken into account. In other words, this was...
In Eden's view, it was a very real problem, and he had to dispose of it, yes.
And how did he dispose of it?
He warned the Jordanians that they could not rely on it. I think Shelby covered that in his book.
I had, if I read that, I'd forgotten the meaning of the point, but that's interesting. So I knew there were the warnings given both to Jordan and to Israel, but not that the Tripartite Declaration was
the Jordanians were warned that they couldn't rely on the Tripartite Declaration if, as a result of the activities on their border, they were to be attacked by Israel.
Well, to get back now, in other words, this is where I would like to begin the question of influence, who had influence, who was a dominant factor, or what, at this time of the various warnings. Beginning there, was Eden and Selwyn Lloyd, were they acting more or less on their own, very much hands-on, without taking counsel from the experts in the Foreign Office?
We're talking now about the period after the nationalization of the canal.
Well, just before the nationalization of the canal.
No, the nationalization of the canal, which changed the whole course of consultation and preparation of policy. Before then, there was close consultation between Eden and Lloyd, and Lloyd and the Foreign Office, and even directly between some members of the Foreign Office and Eden, who Eden knew and therefore had his connections with.
Mm-hmm.
That was going on over all the Aswan Dam issue right up to the end of July. After the nationalization of the canal, Eden was determined that something quite serious had got to be done and that Nasser must be got rid of, and he made no secret of it. He was a man who had always liked to work with a small group of people with whom he felt the word is empathy, I think, but anyhow, working together. And increasingly, he collected those sort of people around him as he faced what he recognized was a real national crisis and a personal crisis for him. Selwyn Lloyd was always in that group of people, but increasingly as the kind of advice that he was receiving was more cautious than that which he was prepared to work on, he was discarding the usual sources of advice to him and working only with those who were in the game, as it were. Game is the wrong word to use, but in the on the project. And so increasingly, the Foreign Office and the Foreign Office people found themselves less and less involved. And the counterpart to that was, I think, that increasingly policy was being formed by ad hoc groups being created for that purpose, which are very difficult to locate. They were partly military, they were partly intelligence, but they were mostly personal around Eden. The what was called the War Cabinet, I don't know what the press calls the War Cabinet, but in fact was called the Egypt Committee, which were members appointed by Eden to take on the crisis.
But Selwyn Lloyd was always part of the inner circle. Lloyd reports again in his book that he met with Doc Marmoshell during this summer after the tension on the Israel border was fairly high, and that they had a conversation about Nasser. Were you present at when you met? I think it was in the airport. No, because he seemed to have gotten some impression of Doc Marmoshell at that particular point.
I think he admired Doc Marmoshell.
Well, this is exactly what I wanted to ask. Now that I'm starting at this point, but to go ahead further through the whole history, then, what was Selwyn Lloyd's impression of Doc Marmoshell?
I think he admired him. He thought that he had a considerable role to play, and he attempted to develop that role in the conversations that he had at the UN in mid-October.
When the Security Council
Assembly.
Right. Or the General Assembly.
Well, the beginning of the General Assembly, I think.
Yes, and then, well, the Security Council, the UK and France took the initiative to call a meeting of the Security Council at the beginning of October.
Did they? Yes. That's right. They took the initiative to call the Security Council together to discuss the Suez Crisis.
Exactly. Yes,
that's right.
Yeah.
And in the margin of that, while they were there, yes, that's what you talked about.
Well, there were important conversations at that point. Switching from Doc Marmoshell now to the American member of the cast, Foster Dulles, a great deal has been said and written about this.
To go back to the talks with Marmoshell, Selwyn had great hopes that those talks with Doug Hammarskjöld had opened up a way of avoiding the use of force.
Well, I wanted to ask that question. Let me ask that right now, because these were the tripartite talks that included the Selwyn Lloyd and Pino and Fassi, the Egyptian foreign minister. And first of all, there's a question as to who took the initiative in arranging these talks, which were outside of the framework of the Security Council. In your recollection or your impression, was it Selwyn Lloyd or was it Doc Marmoshell that took the initiative to bring the three together?
I can't remember. I would have expected it to be Marmoshell, but Selwyn Lloyd would have enthusiastically joined in. That's the one thing he wanted to do, was to avoid the use of force, which he could see coming closer and closer in Eden's timetable.
I see.
And he believed at the end of the talk that he had got just sufficient out of Fawzi for him to succeed in that.
Right.
He hoped that a date at the end of October would be set. In fact, I think it was going to be the 29th of October, wasn't it?
Yes.
Would be set for another meeting in Geneva.
Yes.
And he sincerely believed
that, yes.
That he got just sufficient out of them to be able to go along that line.
Because I believe that Doc Marmoshell also felt encouraged by the outcome of these talks.
Well, I'm sure, yes. That was his nature.
Yes, yes. What happened? Why was why was this not possible to pursue this later? What was the decision on the British side that moved more directly to war?
It was hardly a decision on the British side, was it? I mean, it was the fact that the French and the Israelis had got to the point when they were ready to go, provided that they could bring in the British Canberras. They, unknown to Selwyn, the General Schall had arrived at Chequers while we were in New York.
Yes.
And we were called back early by Eden, and only explanation was only given on returning to London as to why we had to leave New York. Selwyn reckoned that another day or so and he could have got further, but that he had to accept it. I mean, it wasn't so much a decision, it was the fact that the Israelis and the French had come to the point when decision had to be taken trilaterally on whether to let the use of force start.
And I'd like to ask a question there about the timing of the knowledge. I think Selwyn Lloyd has indicated in his book, and I think you just indicated too, that he did not have knowledge at the time that these negotiations were going on in New York of the French-Israeli plan. But there are other indications that the French had informed Ben-Gurion as early as the 1st of September that the British and French might welcome Israeli participation in military action against Egypt. Was this much known by Selwyn Lloyd and its
beginning of September?
Yes.
But obviously it was not a surprise to Eden, to Lloyd when he returned to London, to be told by Eden that the Israelis and the French were had been getting together and were working out a plan. That was not a surprise.
It was not a surprise.
So on the 20th, where are we?
This would have been early October, yeah. You returned to London.
Wait a minute. This is rather important, isn't it? The date of the visit to Chequers is the 16th of October, isn't it?
Or September. I can give you that, yes.
September.
No,
October.
October. That is the date the General Schall and Mr. I think got
16th of October.
Yes.
Well, now, what were the dates of our visit to New York?
The meeting started on the 3rd of October.
On the 3rd, and we returned on the...
You must have returned somewhere the 17th, 18th of October, I think.
That's what I think, too. Let's see, I'm quite sure.
Because I think it was, you were called back just at the time of the General Schall.
Weekend.
Yes.
The 22nd was a Monday, wasn't it? So then the... That's right, yes. The 22nd was a Monday, so then the 15th is a Monday, and therefore the 13th is a Saturday, isn't
mm-hmm.
it?
Yeah.
And I think we returned that Saturday morning.
I think that
we went straight over to Paris the next day.
Yeah. But the real question is whether before even going to New York for the meeting which began on the 3rd of October,
yes.
Selwyn Lloyd already had some knowledge, at least of the possibility of Israeli participation in a joint.
Oh, he surely did, because he attended the meeting on the 27th of October in Paris mm-hmm. with Eden, when the French talked to Eden and Selwyn about their talks with the Israelis.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I should say they must have talked to
yes.
Selwyn and...
That was the 27th of September, right?
27th of September.
Right.
I checked the date. But
no, I haven't. Yeah. No, you said October, but I think you meant September.
I did indeed mean
yes.
September.
Right,
yes,
right,
yes
right.
That's right. But at that meeting in Paris, after the failure of the... Which is the Users Association conference,
right?
Right. Henry James got terribly rightly upset because he was taken along and waited outside for hours at the ambassador while the ministers alone talked about something which was never finally, which was never recorded. That conversation undoubtedly was about, was the French explaining to Selwyn and Eden what they had been talking to the Israelis about. That is the earliest indication that I have of Selwyn learning about the Franco-Israeli talks. I have no reason to think that he knew about it positively before, but I dare say that if Eden knew about it, then Selwyn would have done, but he certainly didn't know any detail of it.
And at that point, it was only the question of possible Israeli participation in a joint action of some kind.
Yes, it was. If the Israelis were to do this, what would the British position be? Which is a very awkward one, because Eden could not possibly have set aside if the Israelis hadn't